Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, Louisville is featured on Antiques Roadshow starting later this month. I'll talk with the show's host and executive producer. First, this year's Kentucky General Assembly approved 114 capital construction projects valued at more than $1 billion. While projects at several universities and the Louisville Zoo did not make the list, one arts entity got a boost. The legislature approved $9 million in bonds for the Kentucky Center to upgrade the 25-year-old state-owned facility. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer reports.
My guide on a tour along a labyrinth of catwalks above the Kentucky Center's Whitney Hall is Joe Massey, the center's vice president for internal operations. Below us are more than 2,000 seats and the stage. Massey stops and points to a steel beam running the width of the backstage area. It is attached to a rigging system near the ceiling.
See these cables? They're holding this I-beam up, which holds this truss, which holds the clouds. These are the acoustical clouds. Depending on who we have in here, opera, ballet, orchestra, the house is positioned, the clouds. For the opera, you want them all the way out. For the orchestra, you want them all the way in.
Massey recounts how he began watching this equipment deteriorate 10 years ago as the cables began to twist and cut into the large beam. 5 years ago, the center immobilized the system with chains and cables for safety. One result has been poor acoustics for all performances. Nearly half of the $9 million will go towards replacing the system. The new system will be able to move acoustical equipment, set pieces, and lights, and make room for extra equipment brought in by touring Broadway shows. The rest of the money will purchase new seating, a new stage floor that is springy enough for dancers, and a modern lighting system that uses nearly 40% less energy. The center's sole owner and custodian is the state, which built the Performing Arts Complex in 1983 to provide the state with a major performance arts venue and stages for the Louisville Orchestra, the Louisville Ballet, the Kentucky Opera, Stage One Children's Theater, and the Broadway series. The center's president, Stephen Klein, has been telling legislators about the facility's deterioration since he took his job in 2005. He says he thinks this year legislators realized the extent of the damage. Part of his message was the center's financial vitality depended on upgrades. Stephen Klein.
Because we were getting behind the eight ball a little bit, we would be less competitive in attracting some of the things that we do or we should be doing.
Those things mean mounting performances that are profitable, especially popular music acts like Lyle Lovett and Broadway shows like Phantom of the Opera. Klein's message wasn't lost on legislators, including House Speaker Pro Tem Larry Clark.
I think that people feel like this is a state facility that does need the upgrading because we're going to lose some of the larger shows and productions. So they've done a good job this session lobbying.
Those larger shows include ones like The Lion King. During the production's run at the center last June, technicians had to do extra work to outfit Whitney Hall with the needed acoustical equipment, which raised the show's production costs here. Leslie Broker is president of Broadway Across America Midwest.
We'll be more competitive and certainly make shows want to come here earlier in their tour.
While the Kentucky Center awaits Governor Steve Beshear's approval of the budget, it has tentative plans to make the renovations in the summer of 2009. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Last summer, the popular public television program Antiques Roadshow brought its cameras back to Louisville. Thousands of people took family heirlooms and other items to the Kentucky International Convention Center for appraisal. The PBS show had previously stopped here in 1998. The Louisville appraisals will be featured in three Antiques Roadshow episodes. The first will air April 21st and can be seen locally on Kentucky Educational Television. Last week, the program's executive producer, Marsha Bemko, and host Mark Wahlberg returned to Louisville for a KET fundraiser and to promote the upcoming episodes. I sat down with them at the 21C Museum Hotel.
We've been all over the U.S. The show's, of course, a big hit. Have you found that there are parts of the country more than others that are maybe more history-minded and more likely to collect or go looking for antiques and that sort of thing?
You know, we live in a great country, and I have discovered that every city has great history. And what antique dealers learned many years ago, and you will find more old things in older cities as far as antiques go. But history, the country's full of great history.
Mark, you're relatively new to the program. How did you get involved with this gig? Was this something you sought out?
You know, I can't say that it was something I sought out. I was a viewer, and then I got a call. Would you like to meet with the Antiques Roadshow people? They're looking for a new host. And I said, are you sure they got the right number? And we met, and it seemed to be a fit. So I'm really, really grateful.
What's this like for you? Do you travel around with the...
I do. I actually show up early to each event. I show up on Wednesday night to the event, and then on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, which is the event, we go out with a small unit and shoot the pieces that you see about midway through the show.
Right.
And then I'm on the floor on Saturday to do sort of the housekeeping stuff I need to do for the show. And then if I get done early, I get to sit with the appraisers and try to learn something.
What's the shooting schedule like, Marsh? I have this vision of like this rock and roll tour and these appraisers getting on a bus and going from town to town.
You're close.
Really?
It is like a rock and roll tour. We travel from city to city. We have two trucks. One is our mobile unit, which is the engineering truck, and then we have a grip and lighting big semi that goes from city to city. The truck drivers actually do it on wheels. The rest of us fly around the country. So not quite a road trip for all of us. Mark and his team, they come out on Wednesdays, and I come out on Wednesdays too. But the rest of the team really flies out on Thursday, and they spend Friday setting up that hall. Saturday we greet our guests. They all show up bright and early. We do the show on Saturday. It's a long day. By the time we strike that set, it's 10 p.m. at night. Everybody goes to bed, gets up, and flies home. Get ready for the next city.
Mm. Let's talk about the Louisville programs that will air starting later this month. There's three episodes this time around?
Three episodes.
I'm sure we're going to see some of those you've got to be kidding moments. I paid 50 cents for that at a fire sale.
It's true. It happens.
Those are better moments than I paid $5,000 and it's worth 50 cents.
Well, I was going to bring that up, too.
Yeah.
that's a tough moment for the appraisers when the people bring in what they think is a...
You know, I wonder if it's a tough moment or some of them actually relish in that moment. You know, there's a little dark side to some of our appraisers that comes out in those moments.
But it says Tiffany on the bottom here. No, I'm sorry.
Well, no, beware.
With one F.
That's the best way to get faked. And you know what I love that our appraisers say? You buy the thing, not the signature. Because the best place to buy something that isn't what it says it is forged signatures, particular Tiffany.
Wow. Have you been with the program its entire run?
I have not.
You haven't?
I did. I was not here for the Louisville first visit.
Oh,
my first trip to Louisville was this past summer.
The show has become so popular, I would imagine. Do you do multiple episodes in just about every community you go into now?
Every city, we usually do three episodes. So we do one event on that Saturday, but we get 5,000 to 6,000 people that come in, and out of that they have enough good appraisals to do three episodes.
How many people turned out last year for this?
I can't remember exactly, but I'm going to say it was somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 people. It was. We had a really, you know what, I am remembering. It takes me a minute. It was a little over 6,000 in this city. We had our biggest turnout in this city of the entire summer, and we give out the same amount of tickets to every city, and that is 8,000 tickets. That's 4,000 pairs. It's free. We are public television, and we know with a free ticket, ticketing experts have told us 20% attrition is what happens. That's what happens with us. If 8,000 people showed up, we couldn't handle it, to be frank. Mm-hmm. And in Louisville, those at over 6,000, we're about a capacity there.
Walk us through the process of how something actually gets on the air. See, I come in with my little lamp and take it from there. I take it to a booth, and then it goes from there.
You've come up to the appraisal tables, which you see on our set, and you see we're there in a circle with all of our experts, 75 to 80 experts in every city, covering 23 categories of objects, from furniture to folk art to silver, deck art, you name it. And most people are going to come in, and we're going to look at your thing, and we're going to tell you it is a vase, and it was used to hold flowers, and it's worth $100. And that's what's going to happen for most people, except for the appraiser sees something interesting. And we are a honest journalistic show, so if they see something, they say to that guest, can you hang on a minute? I want to call the producer. And they sit and they wait for us to come over. We get over there, and I do this along with two people on my team. And we ask the appraiser, we pull him aside or her aside and ask that person to tell us about the object so we understand it, and then we interview the guest. And based on what we're hearing there, we decide whether or not to put somebody on TV.
I see. Mark, has this turned you into an antiques person, or were you an antiques person to start with?
I wasn't. I had interest, but I wouldn't say that I was, and nor am I a collector today, but it has turned me into a student. with 75 professors everywhere we go. And, you know, that's been a real enjoyment for me. You know, not often in my line of work do you get people that are experts in the field and passionate about whatever their field is and willing to share the information. So every time I go and do a piece on location, we spend the afternoon, it's usually just an appraiser, me, and maybe someone else. And in those afternoons, I get a quick lesson on a very specific aspect of collecting.
Like, you won't ever buy, I'm going to guess, a fake Confederate belt buckle.
No, and I'm very clear on what buckles are good and what aren't. And I also, you know, I also know a lot about Navajo jewelry, and because I seem to remember that one, and a little bit about cast iron fountains. Other than that, I really can't help you.
Hey, you know a little something about Cassius Clay and Muhammad Ali.
I know about Muhammad Ali as well.
Yeah. Any Ali, I don't want to give away what's
No, we'll tell you a little bit. Mark can tell you about what he saw at the Ali Museum, but we also had a pair of gloves come in. Boxing gloves that Mike Gutierrez appraised that were signed by Cassius Clay when he was Cassius, I want to say in the 63, does that sound right?
Yes,
it does sound right.
And then signed later in the 90s, I can't remember that year, when he was already ill, signed Muhammad, and you can see the difference in the signatures in his health. And that was appraised at auction. I'll go ahead and give it away. There's so much more juice in the shows for $2,000 to $3,000.
Wow. Is there a lot of stuff that stands out in this part of the country? Is there like more Civil War stuff or more other types of things that stand out that people
bring
in?
We always see regional objects wherever we go. So in Louisville, we saw a great mint julep cup. It just made by a silversmithy who was here, Kendrick, around 1800, which, you know, for us East Coast folks, we are reminded that, in fact, there were accomplished silversmiths here in Louisville at the turn of the century in the 1800s, too.
So one moment in your experience with the show that stands out, that you just, well, I'll never forget that. Wow.
Wearing Elvis's jacket in Memphis. Yeah, the lady offered. I've never have asked.
And was that appraised?
Yeah, that was appraised. That was appraised for, now I have to dig back in my archive brain. I think we said it was worth about $15,000 to $25,000, but if she could find a photo, because it was rumored to come from his comeback tour, if she could find a photo of Elvis in it on the comeback tour, it would be worth $100,000.
Unfortunately, all she could find was a picture of Marcia in it, which didn't help.
Which isn't worth anything.
What about you, Mark? Your experience, relatively new to the program, anything stand out in your mind?
Well, really, I can't really point to specifics as much as the general experience has been so enjoyable. And mostly, you know, my experience is a little different than what happens on the floor. So I really get a chance to get the flavor of every town that we're going into and sort of interface with local people who are passionate about whatever's going on there. So, you know, from quilts in Hawaii to, you know, I took my own little tour of the Louisville Slugger factory, which really wasn't on the Antiques Roadshow agenda, but I had to go there because I'm a baseball fan. But, you know, so I get a chance to sort of tap into the color of every city we're going to, and that's always fun for me.
So what's next for the program? Is there a shooting season and then?
Yes, we shoot in the summers, and we're getting ready for this summer's tour. I think one of the exciting things your listeners might want to hear about is our brand-new website. And on that website, we have all of our appraisals. Frankly, we're populating it now, as web people say. So from season 9 on, eventually we'll have everything in there. And you can build your own roadshow on our website. If you want to see an entire show of boxing gloves, you can organize it for yourself, and it's not a show roadshow is going to make for you. Your Windsor chair show, we're not going to make that show for you, but you can make it for yourself. So pbs.org/antiques, it's worth going.
And you're coming back?
I'm coming back. I always tell people they're going to have to fire me off of this show. This is the one I stick to.
Do you have appraisers that clamor to, you know, please let me join you?
This is
time.
What we're going through now is the assignment process, and the assignments have gone on. And the tough thing is that more people sign up than we can assign. We can't over-assign the areas. The appraisers do pay their own way to come, and we don't want them to come and not have a productive day for themselves as well. They're all clamoring to come. We do our best to keep everybody happy.
Some of them have become stars in their own right. The Kino brothers and others.
Kino men are great men. They're good friends, and they're great supporters of Roadshow. along with Wes Cowan, Noel Barrett, Mike Flanagan. We really Ken Farmer. We have a nice group of celebs who have become celebs from being on Roadshow.
Thank you all for your time, for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Marcia Bemko, executive producer of Antiques Roadshow, and program host Mark Wahlberg. The three Louisville episodes of the program will air on consecutive Mondays starting April 21st. When we come back, Gabe Bullard learns more about a new study that says the gap between Kentucky's richest and poorest citizens is growing. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Robin Fisher talks to the chef at Louisville's Asiatique restaurant about the experience of dining in complete darkness. First, a new study from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and the Economic Policy Institute ranks Kentucky sixth in the nation for inequalities between the richest and poorest members of society. Gabe Bullard talked with Terry Brooks, executive director of the Kentucky Youth Advocates, about the Commonwealth's shrinking middle class.
Please tell me about this study, this income inequality.
Okay. Well, Gabe, what you know, we've all heard the expression, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. What this study reveals is that that is not a cliche, but it really is a portrait of what's happening in Kentucky. Nationally, this study reveals that there is some growth in the gap between rich and poor Kentuckians. However, what we now learn is that that gap is larger in Kentucky than in most places. It's growing faster than anywhere in the country except for five other states. And the other real impact that I think may surprise folks is that it reflects that we have a real shrinking category of folks who we used to call middle-income Kentuckians. It really paints a picture that increasingly Kentucky is becoming a place that is divided by economics between the rich and the poor, with not a whole lot of folks in the middle.
So how does this gap develop?
Well, I think that there's certainly some big factors that we all have to realize. Issues of globalization and the national economy, we would be naive if we didn't think that those kind of factors spilled over into Kentucky, because they do. However, I think our take on it is that at least some of this gap, and I guess I would suggest that a significant piece of this gap, is accelerated by the lack of state policies that address that. We, for instance, know that recalibrating tax policy can bolster middle-income folks and can certainly bolster low-income folks. What current tax policies do is serve, you know, the richest families in Kentucky. We know that when legislators have to make tough budget decisions, and we know they're tough, but we know when they make budget decisions that reduce support services such as transportation, such as child care, such as health coverage, that impact is not going to be felt by the wealthiest 20% of Kentuckians, but it's going to be felt by the low-income Kentuckians. And increasingly, when you talk about cuts in those services, you're talking about impacting middle-income Kentuckians as well.
So what kind of legislation does your group recommend? And yeah.
Well, you know, there's two great examples, one of which we still have some hope for, actually, in the General Assembly. But early on, there was bipartisan discussion around an earned income tax credit. This is an idea at the federal level that was invented by Richard Nixon and championed by both Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton. So it has nothing to do with partisan politics. We know that at the national level, the earned income tax credit, which really just allows working families to keep more of their income, We know that that is the most effective tool that this country has used in the last three decades for moving working folks out of poverty. Kentucky is one of the few states that doesn't have a state-level EITC. So we would like to see that kind of thoughtful reform to the tax code. The other issue that is out there right now that is going to be decided April 14th and 15th in Frankfurt is that we know that a plague that impacts middle and low-income Kentuckians is predatory lending practices. House Bill 500 talks about beginning to address the explosion in payday lending in Kentucky. And so the General Assembly, actually the Senate, still has a shot to take the step ahead to try to equalize incomes in Kentucky by moving ahead and putting some regulations on the unbridled spirit that payday lenders have in Kentucky at the moment. So we don't think that this is an issue that is going to be fixed overnight. There's not a silver bullet. There's not a single policy. There's not a single practice that is going to change this landscape. But we do know that thoughtful tax policies, we do know that tackling some tough issues like predatory lending, and we know that by protecting services such as health coverage and child care, those are ways that we make sure that we don't become a state of haves and have-nots.
How does an earned income tax credit work?
You essentially, if I'm a working family, it simply means that I pay less in taxes. It's it's one of those rare appeals that the most liberal and most conservative policymakers should agree on. Conservatives love it because it reduces taxes. Liberals love it because it really is a very direct support to low income citizens. And again, what is so appealing to that is that it does reward families. It does reward hard work. It is not about some government program. And it has a track record of three decades on the national level. We know that for folks who are teetering between poverty and self-sufficiency, that the EITC is the measure that lifts them out of poverty on a consistent basis.
And this has been proven in other states?
Yes. We have a national EITC. I mean, hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians benefit from that. And a couple dozen states have had that in place for years. This was part of some of the original discussions in the House budget. They really had built in a 7.5 EITC at the state level. It does cost the state money because you're not getting those folks income taxes. So, you know, we do understand that in a revenue tight picture, those are tough provisions to pull off. But for instance, we know that at the federal level, 97 cents out of every dollar that gets returned gets spent in the local economy. So, you know, we in Kentucky are very big on economic stimulus packages. But those economic stimulus packages tend to be for international corporations. This is an economic stimulus package for low-income families. And so we see the EITC not simply as taking money away from the state budget. We see it as a tool to generate money going into local economies. We see it as a win for the state, a win for local communities, and most importantly, a win for low-income families.
But this whole thing, the widening gap, it can't really be just because of a lack of an earned income tax credit
And I said that. You can't talk about this without talking about international and national trends. There's no question about that. But you also it's also very easy to cop out or rationalize away state responsibility. I mean, the easiest thing in the world to do is to wring our hands and say, isn't that terrible, and I wish that we didn't have a trade deficit with China. But you know, what's incumbent upon whether it's the governor or leadership in the Senate or leadership in the House in Frankfurt is to think about, you know, given the context internationally, given the context nationally, what are things that we can do in Kentucky? I mean, when you look at the national pattern, it's not an accident that we have the 10th largest gap in the nation and that the growth of income inequality is the 6th largest in the nation. So there are clearly states that are tackling this problem despite the fact that they have the same international and national economic context that Kentucky has. There are plenty of states, including surrounding states, where we don't see a shrinking middle class, but we in fact see a growing and more vibrant middle class. So, you know, it would be irresponsible for me or for anyone else to talk about this issue only within the context of Kentucky. But the flip side of that is that it really is not responsible for folks to only talk about this problem in a national and international context. We have to have the smarts and the guts to tackle this as Kentuckians.
But what is it that makes a middle class either grow or shrink?
Well, what economists would talk about is for instance, slight recalibration of the tax code. You know, I'm not talking about soak the rich and middle and low income folks don't have to pay anything. But you know, the slightest recalibration, for instance, for the upper 2% of Kentuckians' income tax really could give relief to middle-income folks. And, you know, as April 15th approaches, you know, let's face it, that's something that's on people's minds. And we know that a more equitable, a more progressive kind of tax system can do that. We know that, for instance, some states raise revenue by raising sales taxes and fees that don't clobber low-income families the hardest. There's a lot of discussion in Kentucky about what if we increase service fees. And again, as we go down that route, or if we go down that route, we just need to be conscious that we're taxing services that don't heavily impact low-income and middle-income families.
Like what kind of services would you tax?
Well, you know, what was being proposed were increased sales taxes on charter airplane flights, or country club memberships. Generally speaking, low-income Kentuckians are not going to get heavily impacted by taxing membership fees at Valhalla. That's a progressive expansion of the revenue base. I think the other thing, Gabe, that folks may, that really has changed, the landscape has changed on this, is that there was lots of talk in Frankfurt about the current or the proposed state budget impacting support services like transportation and child care and health coverage, subsidized school lunches or housing vouchers or food stamps. 20 years ago, it was easy for us to relegate those supports to the poorest of the poor. I mean, when you talked about health coverage or child care, those kind of things, you were really thinking about folks that were in dire poverty. What we know is, and the data is pretty clear on it, is that increasingly the folks that get afflicted and affected by those cuts are middle-income folks as well. I mean, we know, for instance, that there are 50,000 children who are eligible for health coverage, for K-CHIP, currently who are not enrolled for all kinds of reasons. Many of those children tend to be in lower middle-class income families as well as what we would generally think of as poor families. So the whole notion, the whole network of social supports impacts middle-income as well as low-income Kentuckians. And And I think that is something that has changed in the last 20 years. So the reach that those kind of social supports have is further up the economic ladder than they were two decades ago.
So why wouldn't they be on K-CHIP?
Well, the current system that the state has is an exquisite. If you think about great customer service, what we have is the antithesis. It's a terrific way to keep families off K-CHIP. For instance, Kentucky is one of only two states in the nation that require face-to-face interviews. You know, we know that if we were to have an enrollment process that encouraged enrollment rather than discouraged enrollment, we would get those kids on. And again, this is not an expansion of the system. It's simply the idea that if we simplify the current system, we will increase the level of enrollment. And for a family, getting a youngster on K-CHIP is a real economic as well as health support. So those are the kind of moderate, measured, common sense steps that we think that folks in Frankfort just have to take responsibility for.
So if a child wants to get on K-CHIP, they have to go in for an interview?
The family does. And you know, it may not surprise you that the office hours, the procedures that are set up for K-CHIP enrollment are great if you're an employee. They're not too great if you're a family. And again, Tennessee is the only state in the country that comes close to Kentucky in making it tough to get on to children's health insurance. So we don't have to look at Connecticut or Wisconsin. We can look at West Virginia. We can look at Indiana and learn ways to make sure that families can get their kids the kind of health coverage that the law says they deserve. You know, what happens if we were able to get enrollments through working with schools across the state? What would happen if we were able to get health enrollment in collaboration with faith communities? Those are very common sense ways that other states tackle the problem of enrollment. But, you know, we as a state really have set up a system to discourage enrollment rather than encourage enrollment.
So back to the gap between the rich and the poor. How did Kentucky get so low? Like, how did this gap get so big in Kentucky in particular? I understand that the gap is widening around the nation, but why Kentucky?
Well, you know, certainly folks talk about, and we would agree with the idea that certain economies, certain state economies tend to bifurcate income. And currently Kentucky is probably in that kind of economic straitjacket where there's increasingly a divide between, quote, good jobs and bad jobs. So, you know, some of those are very big economic kind of pictures, and that's why, for instance, we really need the private sector weighing in along with the public sector, because one of the solutions to this widening gap is to thinking thoughtfully about where do we as a state need to head as a state economy. The second part, again, goes back to very specific state-level policies. And, you know, we're not looking for a silver bullet. There is not a single solution. But we believe that gap can be closed through a series of proactive policy measures. You know, what if we recalibrated the upper 2% income bracket? What happens if we do pass, additionally, a state EITC? What happens if the Kentucky Senate leadership has the courage to act on predatory lending? That's not going to change the economic gap landscape overnight, but it's going to begin to make a difference. And so we see, you know, some of the solutions being big picture, long range economic condition solutions, but we really don't want our policymakers to cop out with we can't do anything about globalization. We want them to take action around proven measures that helps the lot of low and middle income Kentuckians.
So I understand then through that why the poor are getting poorer, but how are the rich getting richer in this same situation?
Well, again, if you look at Kentucky's income tax, state income tax structure, it's a good deal for the wealthiest 20% of Kentuckians. And again, we're not talking about a radical Robin Hood soak the rich. We're talking about that if our tax structure reflected surrounding states' tax structure, wealthy Kentuckians would pay a little bit more, but a little bit more from those folks generates lots for the state's coffers. And so revisions in the tax code is just a great example that would flatten the gap and increase revenue and still be, you know, a very fair kind of a tax system. So that's just one example that we know would generate big bucks for the state in clearly a climate where we're short on revenue. And at the same time, it would have the impact of flattening that gap between the rich and the poor. I think that's especially true when you're talking about the growing gap between middle-income Kentuckians and wealthy Kentuckians. If you look, for instance, at income changes for Kentucky from the middle from the late 90s to the mid 2000s, the income of the poorest 20% of Kentucky families did not change at all. The average increase to the middle 20% was like $300 a year. The richest 20% were almost $2,000 a year. So you're talking about a upper income folks, their income increasing seven times more than middle income Kentuckians. Forget the low income Kentuckians. And I think one of the things that we know is that states that are becoming healthier economically and also finding ways to support their citizens do have a vibrant middle class. So, you know, one of the real concerns that we as Kentuckians should have that all Kentuckians should have, whether you're that top 2% or really in a very, very low income family, is that we all need a growing and vibrant middle class in Kentucky to move the state ahead. When policies and economic conditions deflate the middle class, both the vibrancy and the numbers of folks who are moving into the middle class, we have a problem not just for 2008, but we have a problem that's going to haunt us for a decade to come.
That was Gabe Bullard speaking with Kentucky Youth Advocates Executive Director Terry Brooks. Coming up, fine dining in the dark. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. The Idea Festival, held in Louisville each September, is known for presenting and generating cutting-edge ideas. Local chef Ping Louie is known for his innovative cuisine and artistic food presentation. So what happens when the two get together? Well, you just might be dining in the dark. WFPL's Robin Fisher talked with David Mudd of the Idea Festival and Chef Louie of Asiatique Restaurant about the upcoming Lights Out Dinner and the logistics of preparing a meal to be eaten in the dark.
David, I'm going to start with you. I want you to tell us a little bit about the Idea Festival and your involvement with the culinary events.
I'd be happy to. The Idea Festival is almost whatever occurs to you when you hear that term. Something invented by a man named Chris Kimmel in Lexington, who's director of the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation, which is a kind of venture capital fund for new ideas, new businesses in Kentucky. In that capacity, Chris is always having to think about innovation, creativity, how businesses can come to Kentucky, but more importantly, come from Kentucky, spring up here, and be sustainable. And in his travels and his thinking about all this, he just kept running up against, in this economy in particular, there's a need for creativity, innovation, constant thinking about new twists on old technology, twist on new technology. So he started thinking about how to teach people here that aspect of the new economy, creativity, innovation. And the Idea Festival sprang from that. He thought, if I can just bring people here who are innovative, creative folks, and have them in an open space talk about not so much their inventions or their software breakthroughs as much as the process of being creative, of innovation.
Of the ideas.
Of the ideas. That was the genesis of the Idea Festival. It's been happening now since 2000. The first three took place in Lexington, moved to Louisville in 2004, and is now an annual event. I came along with it in 2006 when the Idea Festival had an idea to invent an event that would kick off each festival called the Taste of Innovation, where we bring mostly independent restaurants in Louisville together for a rollicking cocktail party kickoff that also features demonstrations and really puts an emphasis on the restaurants you have in Louisville, how creative they are, and how creative they can be when asked to be as guests of something called the Idea Festival.
Now, Chef Louis, that brings me right to you. We're talking about being creative and innovative. Is this your first involvement with the Idea Festival?
Not really. When it first started, I was asked to do a demo, which had a conflict of schedule. I didn't do it. But last year, I teamed up with Mike Kunha, who does more of contemporary Southern cuisine, and I do more of the modern Asian cuisine, so we were paired together to find a niche in between. He does his style, I do my style, and that's where the word innovation comes from.
Now, Mike Kunha is with Limestone?
Yes.
This year, you all have gotten together and started dark dinners. So tell us, what's a dark dinner? I know a dark dinner from watching it on CSI.
Okay.
So that is my limited exposure to the dark dinner. So tell us, what is a dark dinner?
I believe it started in Europe. They turned down all the lights. And it was a fundraiser for Blind Society. And it's been happening in big cities on a regular basis. There are restaurants who does that on a nightly basis. This will be the first time it'll be done in Louisville. It's a fundraiser or a dinner that leads up to the Taste of Innovation and Idea Fest. And when Idea Fest approached me, I was all excited, and I still am, and I'm looking forward to the dinner. Simply because my philosophy towards food is should be more global and innovative. There's always something new to incorporate out there.
Well, David, how did you all come up with the idea? Did you see a piece on dark dinners?
Oh, certainly. I think maybe Chris Kimmel saw the same CSI program. There's a long article about the phenomenon in the New York Times last summer. And so the consciousness, the awareness of that came up just about the time we felt the Idea Festival was at the point where it could think about staging some events, not necessarily during the three-day event that happens in late September. So we talked about what we should do, and the Taste of Innovation event has been such a success the past 2 years that it seemed natural to look to food, to some sort of innovative thing we can do with food, and how we could bring people together for one, two, or three events in the off months.
Plus, Louisville is such a foodie town.
Yes.
Yeah. We love to eat here. Yeah. Chef Louis, how do you go about preparing a menu for a dinner that's held in the dark?
First of all, on a regular menu, there are five senses. So when you lose one, you need to enhance the other four. And obviously, without a sight, plating up is not a big issue. So you need to boil down to flavor. So what I'm trying to do, pair duets, as in two different flavors.
Oh, interesting. It's
on a lighter, on a heavier, and there's more components involved. So the mind has to start wondering what flavors has been incorporated into the dish itself, whether it's a protein or a sauce or the vegetables.
Now, will you introduce the dishes beforehand, or will people not know what they're eating?
I'd rather them not know, and as they eat it, I will go through with them my philosophy and what I put in there and see whether they have gotten it correct, see how good the taste buds are.
So they get, so the diners arrive, and then they are blindfolded. Is that right?
We haven't worked out the choreography exactly yet. There's a mild argument going on about whether to blindfold the guests as they arrive and then help them to their tables, or whether everyone goes into the room, sits at their table, and then is blindfolded.
And, but so the guests will remain blindfolded throughout the...
Throughout, yes. I don't think there will be any... They won't be allowed to take them off between courses.
Now, will the servers have enough light to see, or will they wear night vision goggles?
That's the reason for the blindfolding, because there have to be enough light for the servers to present the food, to pass out the food, and yet the guests will not be able to see it with the blindfold situation.
I will put in a plug for the third Lights Out dinner we plan to have will be at the Patron, the small restaurant on Frankfurt Avenue. And we are hoping at that point that we know enough about what we're doing to where we can stage a completely dark dinner there. News about that later.
Well, I have some just sort of, I guess, mechanical questions. Will people be using silverware?
They're probably using just a small spoon or fork.
And they will be somehow know where their glass is?
Yes. Glass is normally on the right-hand side, so it shouldn't be a problem.
Peng's normal wait staff will be attending, and there will be several Idea Festival people in the room to provide whatever sort of aid is necessary.
So are the servers being trained for this dinner specifically?
Slowly but surely they would have to, because we are as blind as everybody is coming to this dinner. It's never been done before in Louisville, and it should be very interesting.
So have either one of you ever been to a Lights Out dinner before?
Nope.
I had my daughter tie a sock around my eyes the other night just to give it some kind of run through. And even with that, I didn't cheat. It's an experience. Even with all the lights on, that takes enough away to where the other senses immediately kick in.
If someone wants to know more about how to attend the dark dinner at Asiatique, what do they need to do?
Go to the Idea Festival website. It's ideafestival.com. We are the agency selling the tickets. So go there, and you can call or register via the website. And it's Thursday night, Asiatique, at Thursday night, April 17th at 6:30.
So what we'll have to do then for our next interview is talk to some people who have dined in the dark.
Yes.
So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with David Mudd of the Idea Festival and Chef Louis of Asiatique Restaurant about the upcoming Idea Festival Lights Out Dinner scheduled for Thursday evening. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog online at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.